Coming up on Weekend America.
Maybe the thin air is getting to people's heads, or it's just convention excitement. But the mayor of Denver is rocking the political karaoke.
We will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of the American people in three simple words.
Yes, we can.
Would that be Obama-yoke? I'm John Moe. Also, a different kind of intoxication. What would a lower drinking age mean to college freshmen?
If you're 18 and sitting on a bar stool, you can't really draw attention to how young you are by getting way too drunk and falling off it.
And can an out-of-shape actor stack up against Bruce Jenner's decathlon scores? No.
What? 17-22. Jenner at 10.55. Schroeder at 17.22. I think the track conditions were a little slow today.
The radio show of champions, Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From St. Paul and across the USA, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. As college students get ready to go back to school, some university presidents think it's time to revisit the drinking age, maybe lower it to 18 to curb binge drinking. Some critics say that will have the opposite effect. What about the people it would affect the most? This hour, we talked to some students, a college alcohol counselor, and the manager of a bar near Boston, where they have some colleges. Also, we hit the Minnesota State Fair and meet a third-generation kitchen gizmo salesman. He slices, he dices. I believe he even makes julienne fries. Plus, decathlons for non-decathletes. What are you doing this weekend?
I hope that this weekend we're going to have a baby. We're expecting a boy.
I am an exhibitor in an art show in Perrysburg, Ohio.
I'm going to be packing up all my stuff to move to my dorm.
I am going to bartend on Saturday night for my first time.
I've got a housewarming party to go to.
I'll also be working in a bike shop on Saturday afternoon.
I also promised a friend I'd be playing tennis with him.
And then I'm going to serve coffee on Sunday.
Okay, well, I like to think at least somebody somewhere is relaxing. Not sure, though. Those voices came from Lincoln, Nebraska, Ann Arbor, and Boston. Barack Obama and Joe Biden are kicking off their campaign together in Springfield, Illinois today before heading the presumptive Democratic ticket through Wisconsin, Iowa, Missouri, and Montana on their way to Denver for the Democratic National Convention. Meanwhile, other Democrats from around the country are also on their way to Colorado by plane, train, and Prius for their party's party. On Monday, the delegates, regular and super, will get down to business, hammer out this year's party platform, pump themselves up, and the rest of America, they hope, for the general election season. But Denver's not waiting till then to get the party started. We sent our reporter Chrissy Clark there this weekend to bring us a dispatch from the pre-convention preparations.
We are tired of business as usual in Washington.
Barack Obama doesn't get to Denver till Thursday.
We are hungry for change.
But his words are already ringing from this podium at a karaoke bar in downtown Denver. On stage, a man in a button-down shirt is performing an actual Obama speech.
Of the American people.
Talk about the political theater of convention season.
Yes, we can.
To make it more surreal, the man reading off the karaoke screen is the mayor of Denver, John Hickenlooper.
Thank you, South Carolina. I love
He's
you.
Kicking off a series of Convention Week art installations sponsored by the city. This piece is called Convention Karaoke, and people in bars across Denver will be able to read along to their favorite political speeches. So how does the mayor feel being Obama?
You know, I tell you, you realize what the man stands for and how hard he works to communicate who he is and what he believes in. You know, it made the hair stand up on the back of my neck just because you can see how he believes it and you can see how people respond to that message.
The Obama phenomenon that we've gotten used to this primary season is at a whole new level now in Denver. Over at DNC Volunteer Headquarters, organizers are trying to figure out just what to do with all the people who want to help. 26,000 volunteers, compared to 15,000 at the DNC 4 years ago. A coordinator named Emily Brooks says the excitement has gone way beyond T-shirts and bumper stickers.
One of our volunteers who's going to be here next week has custom-made embroidered dresses that have Obama across the front. They're beautiful, and she's going to be wearing them.
Brooks is in charge of the call center that gives out assignments to eager convention volunteers, like the woman who flew in from Chicago for one day to stuff media bags, or the Clinton supporter who just wants to hug Hillary and shake Obama's hand. There's the 90-year-old who calls herself the Obama mama, and 26-year-old Korea Dwanyan.
I'm excited. Ah! My camera's already charged.
You know, some people talk about the, like, oh, Obama mania, and he's too much of a celebrity. And
that's
what do you
just think? Ridiculous. I think what this country needs is a lot of people that are actually excited and, you know, like, motivated, because they're just, it's in a rut.
50,000 of those excited, motivated people are expected to be in Denver for the convention, and local businesses are hoping to impress and sell things to them. At the airport, you can buy a stuffed donkey within seconds of walking off your plane. Elsewhere, you can have your picture taken in front of a 12-foot-tall snow globe, courtesy of Vail Resorts. Meanwhile, the mayor's declared his ambitions to make this convention, quote, the greenest in the history of the planet. Well, not compared to the last DNC that Denver hosted in 1908, which had a tiny carbon footprint through no efforts of its own. But for a modern convention, the city's doing pretty good, according to Perry Burnap, Denver's director of convention greening.
Our goals have been always not only to minimize the environmental impact, but to create permanent change.
This year, delegates can get around on bikes and hybrid SUVs. They can eat, sometimes, on compostable plates. And delegates will learn to sort their recyclables.
God bless them.
All of which amuses Mary Smith.
If they want to pick through all of the trash of 50,000 visitors, I think that's going to be a tough haul.
Smith is in one of the few bars downtown that is not draped with Welcome Democrat signs. She's chair of the Denver County Republicans. In the last few years, politics in Colorado and the Rocky Mountain West have shifted to the left, but there are still plenty of conservatives in town this week. The state GOP has rented a theater to premiere a new film called Hype, The Obama Effect. Others will take the charm offensive.
Republicans and their kids will be passing out some water bottles and things for people. Make sure that they know that we welcome them.
What sense is that? Why am I going to vote for you when you're not going to do nothing but forget me after I put you up in that White House?
Some in Denver aren't lobbying for or against the Democrats this week. They just feel left out. Like these homeless veterans.
First step to me in solving problems of veterans is not making so damn many of them.
I hope you know that I've walked away to protect...
Their recorded voices will be projected from the gun barrel of a Humvee that's rolling around town, another of the art installations sponsored by the city, and an attempt to extend this week's political engagement beyond the walls of the convention hall. Other political acts, the city's keeping at a distance. The so-called free speech zone, where protesters are allowed, is almost completely out of eye and earshot from the convention hall. Of course, before the convention or the protests start, there's still spiffing up to be done. A woman stoops over a long brass railing on the steps to City Hall, polishing. The rails are black, except for the parts she's already shined.
I'm working off a ticket.
a parking ticket?
Well, actually, I didn't come to a complete stop at a stop sign.
What's your name?
Vanessa Lawrence.
Lawrence tells me she couldn't pay the ticket because she just lost her house to foreclosure. She moved here from Mississippi in 2005 after her home there was destroyed by Hurricane Katrina.
If I can go through Katrina, surely I can do this.
She says she's not really involved in the convention this week, but she does have a touch of DNC fever.
I am very much so an Obama supporter. So I'm excited because, you know, it being new and in all of this, so it's exciting.
Then Lawrence goes back to polishing the railing. She's got 2.5 more to shine before Monday. In Denver, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Well, in Denver, Barack Obama will, of course, become the first African-American to win the presidential nomination of a major American political party. There's been a lot of speculation about how that fact sits with white Americans, but who's asking African-Americans how they feel about that topic, or other topics for that matter? Radio One is the largest American media company that targets African-Americans, and this week it published a major survey. 3,000 people in the African-American community were polled. about a wide range of issues. And it turns out blacks are evenly divided over being called black or African-American. Weekend America's Desiree Cooper asked Radio 1's Alfred Liggins about some of the other results, particularly what surprised him most about the online life of African-Americans.
Historically, people have thought that there was a digital divide where black people weren't as online, as much online as whites. And the survey actually points out that 68% of all African-Americans are online versus 71% of the total population. But it also says that African-Americans are adopting broadband at a faster rate than whites are. So when they come online, they have many more capabilities because they're going with the higher speed connections that offer more rich media options.
Your survey then said that not only is the black community not monolithic, but it's more complex than you might have imagined?
Oh, absolutely. The segments that felt they were most discriminated against were, in order, a segment called Stretched Black Straddlers, which are mostly the 18 to 34-year-olds. They're online, carry cell phones, spend a lot of time with black TV and websites, and they say they've been racially discriminated against in the past 3 months. However, the second most discriminated against, or segment that felt that they were the most discriminated against, is the new black middle class. And they are the best educated, most employed, wealthiest segment, and are between the ages of 25 and 44. And they probably feel this way because they are the most assimilated, so they probably have the most sort of conflict points, if you will.
So you're saying that there's like a segment of the black community that's younger, they're stressed out because they're uncertain about their place in larger American society, and yet they're not as willing to blame that on racial oppression.
That's exactly right.
And then you have a middle class that is actually doing much better, but are still more keenly aware of racial oppression and are more likely to say that racism exists and is a big part of their lives.
Yeah, that's correct.
You know, I've also noticed how often politicians, when they're trying to go toward a particular group, get folksy and try to talk to that group in a way they think that group will listen to them. So you will see ads pointed toward the black community that might have gospel music.
Mm-hmm.
They might even use slang. And we've seen how slang has really run awry of the black community. Fox News calling Michelle Obama Barack Obama's baby's mama, if I can get that out. How does the African-American community feel about slang?
We asked an agreement question on black slang or street talk. And the question was stated as, black slang or street talk is an important way of staying connected to black culture. And what we found is only 22% overall agreed with this, and almost 60% disagreed. The three segments with the highest level of agreement were what we call connected black teens, black onliners, and stretched black straddlers. And these are three of the youngest groups, and they're very tied into their culture and blackness. Three segments at the opposite end were new middle class, faith fulfills, and digital networkers. Digital networks is actually a young group as well, but they are not tied into their blackness.
Well, Alfred, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Des. It was a pleasure.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
McCain can't recall how many houses he owns. As for how damaging that will be, I'll have to have my staff get back to you. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Well, it's been a strange week in the news, a lot of looking forward and a lot of distraction. The political conventions are coming up. That's got everybody thinking about the weeks ahead. The Olympics were going on. That's got everybody thinking about various athletes in China. But we need to sort through the news of the week. Things did happen this week, and here to sort it into categories of good news, bad news, or no news is Weekend America's Bill Radke.
Thanks, John. With us this week are the author of the Ask a Mexican column, Gustavo Arellano. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola.
Writer-producer John Ridley. Hey, John.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Good. And political consultant Tara Settmayer. Hey, Tara.
Greetings.
This week in politics, John McCain was asked how many homes he and his wife own, and he couldn't remember. Obama called him out of touch. The McCain campaign responded that Obama lives, quote, in a frickin' mansion. Is this housing crisis good news, bad news, or no news?
You know, this is no news, in my opinion, only because we're talking about the rich and powerful across the board. It's not news that members of the Senate are millionaires or have multiple homes. Where this is bad news is that it's an example, though, for, again, of where there's a lack of discipline in the McCain campaign. You know, it's bad enough that he's trying to shake this image of being a senile old man that can't remember, you know, what he did 5 hours ago. And when he comes across the way he did in answering this question, it just solidifies that stereotype that, you know, that he's this old coot that can't remember what's going on.
No news slash bad news, says the Republican. Others?
I'll go to good news slash bad news. Good news, obviously, for Barack Obama. It's just another, after a week where he was really taking a lot of beatings for appearing at the Saddleback Church Forum alongside John McCain, finally he has something that he could really use to belittle John McCain. But it's bad news, though, just in case John McCain does become president of the United States. How can we have somebody who doesn't know how many homes they own? I know every single residence I've ever lived in my life. I think most people would
know. And
the
phone numbers. John?
I have to say no news, and let me preface this by perhaps getting myself in more trouble than I've ever been. I performed a little test. I asked my wife how many homes we own. She got the answer wrong. She's not an old Republican.
Uh-huh.
So it can happen to anybody.
Really?
And by anybody, you mean extremely wealthy Americans.
Well, isn't that everybody, right? Is there something wrong with the economy that I wasn't aware of? But here's my problem, though, honestly. I think it's no news. I don't think it matters that John McCain or Barack Obama are painted as elitist. We're electing the president of the United States. I hope to a degree they are elitist. But can they understand, can they take their elitism, their better education, and their more opportunities and help the average American with the advantages that they have?
So you think this whole out-of-touch discussion we have all the time is bad news? The windsurfing John Kerry, John Edwards' $400 haircuts, George Bush Sr. in the supermarket scanner, that's a bad road to go down?
All of these individuals say something at some point that somebody else can grab and say is elitist. But there's this odd metrics. You know, when does being an educated person who strives very hard and has accomplished thing turn into elitism? You know, John Kerry went to Ivy League school. George Bush went to Ivy League school. One was elitist and one was regular folk. So I just think it's one of these gotcha nonsensical questions, and it takes our eye off of what's really important in the world. They're both quite wealthy. One is more so than the other. But are they capable and can they take their advantages and help the average American? That's what's important.
Okay, our next topic. This fall, a rural Texas school district will be the first in the country to let teachers bring guns to class. Teach is packing. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's bad news.
How's that?
You know, if schools are concerned about guns or kids bringing in guns, then they should hire security experts or people trained to use guns. I think expecting teachers to also be firearms experts and be able to protect their students is just, it's a little much. I understand some people are freaked out about school shootings. I think there was one just the other day, a kid was shot. But I don't think teachers are necessarily the ones in a panic situation would be the best to have firearms and to start shooting. And I think also when the police show up, they don't know who's got a gun. And if they see an adult that they're not familiar with brandishing a weapon, you're asking for a firefight.
Others?
Let's just put this in perspective. This is a rural town in Texas. There's 150 students in this school system. You know, I mean, guns are a part of the culture in Texas, just like pickup trucks and cowboy hats. And I think it's good news in that it's good news for the Second Amendment, which I happen to still believe in. And if this is what the localities decide to do, then that is their constitutional right to do it.
And there you have the arguments.
God bless America. Bad news for this reason. One of my favorite YouTube clips involved a security guard who was in a classroom teaching kids about gun safety. And while he's teaching them about gun safety, the gun goes off. It hits his foot. And he then goes, okay, it's all my mistake. It's all bad. And this guy was fully trained, went through all the crisis management. But I think to put a live gun in a classroom, no matter how many security measures you may have to make sure that the gun doesn't go off, eventually it'll go off. Eventually something will happen.
Well, more kids are killed in car accidents and by cars than they are by guns. So, you know, it's not the guns, it's
because
the people.
There's too many cars on the road. If we cut back cars like we cut back guns, we wouldn't have that problem. I mean, everybody's got a car. Not everybody's got a gun, thank God.
How many cars do you own, John?
I don't know. I have to check with my staff.
Uh-huh. Our final topic comes from the Canine Science Forum in Budapest. Researchers report that dogs are learning ethics from people. They've acquired an awareness of fair play and a distaste for foul play. Is that good news, bad news, or no news? And feel free to ask a dog if one is nearby, because they have a moral compass.
I read this and I said, how do they make this determination? Clearly, this assumption that the dogs are have a sense of morals and values based on this research. I don't know how they came to that conclusion.
Did you read the study? They one dog, you raise the paw and you give him a treat. The other dog, you know, raise the paw, no treat, and the
that's
dog
not,
says, "What's that? What's
how do you determine?" Yeah, but I don't know. How do you determine that's a moral decision that they made?
So what kind of news is it, Tara?
I think it's no news.
Can't believe you think this is no news. This is the Canine Science Forum in Budapest.
The most renowned canine science forum ever. Was this a setup question, can I ask?
Why do you ask, John?
Because you know how I feel about animals gaining intelligence.
Yeah, come and think of it.
What do you think about animals being intelligent, John?
You know how I feel about it. The animals are taking over, and all they do on this show is propagate animal intelligence and, oh, it's great that they're getting smarter and all this kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And Bill is such an apologist for the smart animals. It's nauseating. And you always ask these questions because they're trying to make me seem like some kind of crazy man. Oh, he'll answer. And then nobody will pay attention when the animals take over. Yeah. Oh, let's teach the animals how to use nuclear weapons, too.
Scientists think that dogs are learning paranoia from John Ridley.
Every time I'm on, you have a question about the animals getting smarter. This is beyond no news.
That's the news this week. Panel, thanks a lot.
Gracias.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Political consultant Tara Setmayer, Gustavo Arellano, he writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. When he's not fearing the advent of hyper-intelligent animals, John Ridley writes an NPR blog called Visible Man. His latest book, The American Way, is a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
How much would you pay for a story on a third-generation kitchen gadget huckster on the state fair circuit? He slices, he dices. He's ahead on Weekend America. We'll be right back.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Ever since the advent of the VCR, Saturday night network TV has been a black hole. Low ratings, low interest. But last Saturday, NBC saw their highest ratings in over 20 years thanks to Michael Phelps's 8th gold medal. So, what was NBC's last Saturday night primetime show to have higher ratings than Phelps?
Life goes on, and so do we. Just how we do it is no mystery.
Empty Nest. You know, Empty Nest. Richard Mulligan, Christy McNichol, Dinah Manoff. No? Don't remember that? Well, let's get a little help from Sacramento Bee television columnist Rick Cushman. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you very much.
What was Empty Nest?
Good question. Who hardly knows? It was actually a spinoff of Golden Girls back in the early 1990s.
Was Empty Nest a remarkable show? Was it a historic show?
Clearly not. Actually, its highest ranking was at one point. It was 7th for the year. Its ratings were solid, but nothing great. And even that night was not an especially particular night. It was just that it was during sweeps. There was sort of a momentum. And in 1990, people still watched some television on Saturday nights.
I'm going to read you the synopsis of this episode of Empty Nest. Carol dates a blind man and focuses only on his disability, ignoring the fact that he is rude and obnoxious. And Jeffrey Milstein is nervous about a chess tournament. That's it.
That sounds like brilliant television, doesn't it? You know, if you go back to Saturday Night Television a few years before that, you know, ABC had shows like Love Boat, which was a huge hit. Or CBS had a lineup that included things like The Carol Burnett Show, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Newhart. I mean, some of the best television ever was on Saturday nights, and they were getting massive audience and certainly massive percentages of audiences. But that was in an era when there was three networks and we had nowhere else to go.
Was there a particular reason this episode was so popular?
Well, it actually works in the other direction. It's that this was the last relatively popular episode as people found other, not only just found other things to do, but other forms of entertainment. In that case, it was the VCR. You know, NBC has not had a spectacular lineup on Saturday night since then, really. So this was just sort of the last of the good shows on NBC. Now, remember, this was also NBC's best showing on Saturday night. There were still a few other shows on Saturdays that were doing better, like, you know, Walker, Texas Ranger type shows that for the next few years that drew pretty large audiences.
You know, we're sitting around the office here talking about TV on a Saturday night. I couldn't think of a single show that was on. What is on network TV on Saturday nights these days?
Nothing. It might as well be Bars and Tones. The networks have given up on programming Saturday night. They don't even run movies anymore.
They could put anything they want on a Saturday night, really. It's like a tree falling in the forest. Nobody would have any idea.
Well, that's been the argument, you know, and one of the arguments has been why not try something different and unique. It costs the network so much, in some ways so much more than cable, because cable lives on a lower budget. They give smaller guarantees to advertisers. They also get a little extra money based on the fact that they're being carried by a cable system. But the networks operate large. They operate like movie studios in a way, which is that big expense, big return. So they basically have given up on Saturdays.
Anything good on TV this weekend?
The Olympics? Actually, the truth be told, there isn't much competition. Yeah. And if the Olympics weren't on, NBC would run a Dateline. CBS would run repeats of its crime shows like CSI and Without a Trace. ABC probably would run one of their 2020s or something, or primetime. And Fox would have Cops and Most Wanted, which doesn't cost much to make. And then out on cable, you start to actually see some real shows. But even then, they all know that most people aren't watching. On Sunday nights, however, people tend to turn around and go back to television, although this Sunday will be the closing ceremonies of the Olympics. So that'll be a pretty big draw.
Rick Cushman, TV columnist with the Sacramento Bee. Thanks, Rick.
You're welcome.
On the social networking website Facebook, swimmer Michael Phelps has 1,364,305 fans. Empty Nest has 13. It used to have 12, but then I joined, so now it has 13.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. We are now in late August, and that means back to school. And on college campuses, there is a heated debate raging about alcohol. More than 100 college presidents have signed a petition calling on lawmakers to consider lowering the drinking age from 21 to 18. Proponents say the current age limit encourages dangerous behavior, such as binge drinking, while opponents say easier access to booze will cause more problems like DWIs. We wanted to put theory aside and get the perspective of people who would be most affected by this. DJ is 17 and will be a freshman at college this fall. She had her first drink at 16 while out with friends.
From my group of friends, most of them think it's like really cool and they can't have fun without drinking. They think older parties like college parties, for example, are cool. And when they go to like things like that, they see people drinking. So that's like why they want to drink. If they lowered the drinking age, I really don't think anything would change too much because everywhere I've gone, no matter what age they are, they drink anyway. So I really don't think it would change too much, except they can get their own drinks now instead of having somebody else get them for them.
Hi, I'm Kathy Kadama, alcohol prevention specialist at UC Berkeley's University Health Services. My feeling about the debate in lowering the drinking age is that there are so many complex issues that impact on people's individual and community choices to drink, that just to change one factor, the drinking age, is not the place to start. Alcohol is highly marketed, it's very visible, and through the commercial and entertainment media, is very much linked and associated with going out, having fun, which creates a social norm or expectation that drinking is a natural part of both college life and just life in America in general.
Nothing, B. Just watching the game, having a bud.
What's up?
But when I do, I prefer Dos Equis.
Mess with the high life, and the high life will mess with you.
The data that we have shows that the risk of alcohol-related consequences are more likely to happen with students when they first enter college. A couple things that we're focusing on. The first one is large, out-of-control parties where no one's watching out for each other's well-being. We see a lot of accidents, injuries, alcohol poisoning, and unfortunately sexual assaults. So we're working with individuals for how, if you're attending a large party, how can we intervene and make those settings safer? The other tactic that we're taking is really to get people to take individual responsibility for themselves and others in any type of setting and to really recognize that it's in everyone's best interest to prevent overintoxication.
Hi, I'm Katie. I'm a junior at Boston University. What I've seen at college is most people are pretty reasonable about it, but, you know, there are times when freshmen come in and you see them, like, vomiting on the dance floor, things like that, but that's mostly, like, freshman year things. I think alcohol is so attractive when you first get to college because you've never really had the sort of unfettered access to it that you do have. And so you sort of get it, and it's, you know, it's a fun thing to do. And so people just go overboard before they realize, like, how to be more mature about it. If the drinking age were lowered to below 21, I think little would change except people might become more responsible about it. I would hope that the people who are 18 and in bars would behave themselves like all the other 21-year-olds in bars who have had the practice with it and know how to handle themselves. They'd sort of follow suit. You know, if you're 18 and sitting on a bar stool, you can't really draw attention to how young you are by getting way too drunk and falling off it.
My name is Matthew Nault. I live and work in Alston, Massachusetts, and I've been the general manager of O'Brien's Pub for 2 years now. Students from Boston University, Boston College, Northeastern, being a college neighborhood, there's quite a few colleges around here. Right now, the drinking age is 21, and you know, some of the problems we do run into, I mean, aside from like fake IDs and people are under 21 trying to get in, I've found that the younger the clientele, the more problems there is, the more need there is for extra security, to break up fights and whatnot. Seems that, you know, the younger crowd is less experienced with drinking, so therefore it's kind of a free-for-all, it seems, when they turn 21. They're going to have to really, you know, just kind of like educate the kids more about, you know, I guess more kind of casual drinking as opposed to going out with the point of getting messed up. With that said, I do believe that, you know, since at 18 years old you can go to war and die for your country, you should be able to go into a bar and have a beer.
More than 100 college and university presidents have signed a statement encouraging lawmakers to consider lowering the drinking age. It's called the Amethyst Initiative. For more information, go to our website, weekendamerica.org. You're listening to Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul, where the state fair started this week. And it is a big deal around here. People talk about it all year long. In fact, it's fair season across the country this weekend. Rides, animal exhibits, gigantic vegetables, butter sculptures, and any kind of food on a stick you can imagine. At our fair here in Minnesota, they have casserole, we call it hot dish, on a stick, spaghetti and meatballs on a stick, bacon on a stick, pizza on a stick. I'm going on Monday, and I'm planning to show up hungry. Billy Newcomb knows the fairgrounds intimately. It's his office, really, and his home. His family has been selling kitchen gadgets at the fair for 75 years. If it slices, dices, cleans, or mops, Billy's family has probably sold it.
All right, watch this. This thing's unbelievable. If you buy this thing just for chopping onions, you got your money's worth. I'm not kidding you one bit.
My father started selling just a few years prior to booking this fair. This was one of the first fairs he booked in the United States. Back in the 30s, he went to the boardwalk in New Jersey. He saw a gentleman selling a single little tiny vegetable cutter for a dollar. He acquainted himself with the man, got into the business, and he made a living traveling around the Midwest, hawking kitchenwares and slicers at fairs and festivals.
Ladies and gentlemen, watch this. You haven't seen anything yet. How many of you out there like coleslaw? I refuse to pay $1.89 for a little plastic bag, and when you open it up, everything's brown in the sun.
One of the first items my father sold here at the Minnesota State Fair was called the Feimster Slicer. It was a platform slicer, and back in those days, almost every lady in the Midwest put up their own vegetables. That's the way things were. You didn't go buy a tin can in the grocery store. This Feimster Slicer took corn off the cob, sliced carrots, potatoes, cucumbers, and it sold for a dollar. We're selling a larger food processor now for 30. I'm sure he couldn't imagine us getting $30 for a kitchen gadget out at the fair.
Nobody's going to spend that much money, kid.
All right. You haven't seen anything yet. I'm going to show you the new attachments. Remember I showed you what the handle? Oh, you bet. Watch this.
As soon as I could push a two-wheeler around the fairgrounds, I started in this industry. When I was in high school, my father actually let me have a booth of my own. I put the headset on and have been selling ever since.
Julienne. I love that word, Julienne. Don't get too excited. It's a French word for shoestring. Ladies and gentlemen.
6 months out of the year, I'm on the road taking our store to the people. And everybody says, boy, you got it made, man. My high school buddies, you only work 6 months out of the year. I say, follow me. I'm on the fairgrounds at 6:30 in the morning running stock. The building closes at 9 o'clock. I go back to the warehouse and reload, add it up. I'm living on 5 hours of sleep this entire 12-day fair. Better salesmanship through caffeine. That's my motto, all right?
Homemade salsa. How many of you out there like garlic? You like, ask your physician. It's the healthiest vegetable you can eat. If you have a hard time sleeping at night, eat garlic before bed. You sleep like a baby. You know why? You're going to sleep alone, darn straight, lady.
The strongest sales pitch I have is I'll say, how many of you out there own our little chopper? A third of the audience will raise their hand. And I look them right in the eyes and say, would you recommend it to people? They look back at me in the audience and say, I wouldn't live without it. How's that for a sales pitch? A lot of people that don't even buy my product come every year to hear my new jokes. And boy, I've got some real corny ones. I put jalapeno in my salsa. And I look right at the audience and say, ladies and gentlemen, If I put in a third, it's medium mild.
A half of one, it's hotter than the dickens. How many of you out there like the hot stuff? Like, I'm addicted to it. My wife thinks I'm insane. I don't know where I got it.
Now, people you don't like, put in two jalapenos. Relatives, that's three. My mother-in-law, that's four. And I'm kidding. I like my mother-in-law. Honest to goodness, she's a wonderful lady. It's her daughter I can't stand.
Put your hand right on top. Look at here. That son of a gun chops salsa. Pico de gallo. Muy picante. See, I'll go right back on there and give it four more cranks. How's that for some good-looking salsa, folks? Oh, you've got to try this. How much are they?
Billy Newcomb can be found at the Minnesota State Fair among the doohickeys, gizmos, and what's it. Pictures of Billy in action and his special salsa recipe are at our website, weekendamerica.org. Generally dry in the western part of the country today, mild in the northeast. Some hailstorms possible in the upper Midwest. For more details, as well as opportunities to have fun in the waning weeks of summer, here's Stephanie Curtis.
Throwing out the first pitch at a baseball game is an honor. But Huntsville, Alabama doesn't think it needs to be an exclusive honor. They opened their minor league park 19 hours early, right after midnight, to break the record of 8,303 people throwing out the first pitch amid showers and temps ranging from 68 to 89. Guys, just give Roger Clemens a bucket of steroids and he can throw 8,304 pitches himself. Is Wisdom the best name for a town that holds a golf tournament in a cow pasture? Sunny 79 and probably smelly, as Wisdom, Montana holds the Big Hole Cow Pasture Golf Tournament. The president, this is true, is invited to play every year, but never shows up. Must resist making a crack about politicians and BS. Don't set your house on fire in Nashua, Iowa. All the firefighters are busy. Sunny 81 and a few thunderstorms for a kind of tug of war. Big ball on wires moved back and forth by water sprayed from hoses by opposing teams of firefighters. It's called the Fireman's Waterball Competition. More exciting still, the Waterman's Fireball Competition. That one gets crazy. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Stephanie Curtis for Weekend America.
Can an out-of-shape non-athlete become a competitive decathlete in just 4 days? I wish the answer was yes. It's not. The answer is no. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The 29th Olympiad finishes up tomorrow in Beijing. If you've watched any of the games, and chances are you have, you've witnessed athleticism at its finest. We won't soon forget watching Michael Phelps, the American swimmer, win 8 gold medals in a single Olympics, becoming arguably the greatest Olympian ever. But that's just it. Phelps swam, we watched. On the couch, feet propped up, snack or two by our side, but not Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder. Charlie likes the Olympics so much, he wanted to be more than an observer.
Bruce Jenner doesn't think I know what the decathlon is.
What is the decathlon? You tell me.
But he's so wrong.
The decathlon is 10 events over 2 days.
Very good.
It is, whoever wins it is deemed the world's greatest athlete.
Yeah, very good. That's better than most people.
Most people. Oh, Bruce, when it comes to the games of the Summer Olympiad, I am not most people. In fact, every 4 years, I get so inspired by the Olympics, I actually get off my couch and exercise. Take 1996, for example. I started running after I watched Michael Johnson set the world record in the 400 meters. In 2004, who wasn't moved by the young swimmer Michael Phelps? I certainly was. And to prove it, I bought a Speedo. And wore it. In public. So when Bruce Jenner assumed I didn't know what a decathlon was, well, I was kind of offended. But then I asked myself, do I really know what a decathlon is? There was only one way to find out.
Is it like one of those dreams where you're running but not getting anywhere?
I actually had to do the decathlon on my own.
And you just keep running, but nothing's happening and you're not going anywhere. Except this is real.
Which involved training.
All right, something just happened where something happened in my knee. Ow. Ow.
Which I did for about 4 days until my left knee gave out. Like my elite athlete peers, I wasn't about to let a little pain get in the way of my quest. Heck, if Tiger Woods can win the U.S. Open with a double stress fracture, I could surely manage to compete in 10 events with a bum knee.
All right. 8908. Decathlon day.
Great athletes always set the bar high for themselves, and I'm no different. My goal? To beat Jenner's marks. First up, the 100 meters. A seminal event for Jenner when he won the decathlon.
I felt like I won it in the first event, the 100 meters, because if my speed is on, I'm ready. The rest of it's just going to happen.
Like Jenner, I'm a decent sprinter. In fifth grade, I won the 50-yard dash. So when I got to the starting line, I felt like my speed was on. But according to Justin, my official scorekeeper, it wasn't.
What was the time?
17:22.
What? 17:22. Jenner at 10:55. Schroeder at 17:22. I think the track conditions were a little slow today.
But there was plenty of time to make up ground. Like in the long jump, where I planned to fly past Jenner's mark of 7.22 meters.
All right, we've got, ooh, look at that, 8.5 feet. Sweet. So that's what? How many meters is that? Like 2.5 or 3 meters? All right, so Jenner had 7. I'm just down. I can make that up somewhere.
But I couldn't. Not in the shot put.
Ow! Ow!
The high jump, or the 400 meters.
Oh my God.
That first day, I ran half as fast and jumped half as high as Jenner, and after only 5 events, had to admit to myself something that I'd secretly known all along, that I'm half the man Bruce Jenner is.
Okay, day 2, decathlon. Anybody else want to do this for me?
With no chance of catching Jenner or anybody else in the history of the sport, I showed up on day 2 to do it all over again.
Runners, take your mark, set, go!
I did the 110-meter hurdles, or as I called them after landing on my face, the 110-meter hurtles. I also did the discus, the javelin, and the 1500 meters. I was so slow in 2 events that I failed to earn a single point. I nearly decapitated Justin with the discus. And with only 1 event left, I did something I promised myself I wouldn't do. Hire a coach to help me compete in the decathlon's most dangerous event, the pole vault.
What do you think the chances of me being able to beat Bruce Jenner are?
That belongs to the pole vault coach, Brooks Morris. Brooks trains the U.S. decathlete Brian Clay in the pole vault, so I was confident that he could make me fly. For 2 days, I trained with him and a few of his students. But time after time, I just couldn't clear the bar. Once, I even came down with my legs on either side of it.
Almost lost the children.
And nearly ended my chances of ever becoming a father. On my last attempt, I held the pole aloft and stared 47 feet away at the bar. Then, I took off down the runway, planted the pole in the box, and soared.
Yeah! Woo! I mean, he made it by like 8 inches.
I cleared the bar, all 5 feet of it. At that moment, I felt confident that, should the need arise, I could easily vault over rock legend Prince, but not if he's wearing heels. I had finally finished. 7,969 points behind Bruce Jenner, but yes, I'd finished, and I could say with confidence, not to mention a bum knee, twisted ankle, and sore groin, that I do indeed know what the decathlon is. In Los Angeles, I'm Charlie Schroeder for Weekend America.
Well, American decathlete Brian Clay, with whom Charlie shared a pole vault coach, won the gold medal in the Olympics. Charlie Schroeder did not win the gold medal in the Olympics. You can see photos and even a YouTube video of Charlie in action. You've really got to see this video. That's at weekendamerica.org. From there, feel free to print off the photos and tape them to a Wheaties box. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton celebrating her son's half birthday this weekend with half cupcakes, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Angela Kim's off to eat food off sticks at the State Fair, Susie Lechtenberg, Desiree Cooper, and Tim Bomba. Also Chrissy Clark, Sasha Aslanian, Brendan Noonan, who's making his friend buy him dinner this weekend, Ocean Kalen, Rob Byers, Phyllis Owens, Millie Jefferson's off to Las Vegas, have fun, Millie, Bill Radke, and Mark Sanchez. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney, also off to the State Fair for his first time ever. Good luck, Peter. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website. That's weekendamerica.org. I'm John Moe. Join us next weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for sweet reminiscences.
What I decided was that I would never have a favorite song and that instead I would hate all music forever.
You know, I don't like Hall & Oates anymore. That's how much I did not enjoy that situation.
We're making new memories, so you can go ahead and forget those old ones. Join us for the next Weekend America.